Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to your last 231 class, except for the final. All right, so we're going to talk about diversification system today. And let's see, today is, what, the 16th? Am I right? All right, on. Yes. All right, so this week we do have lab practicums. We had one, we had two on Monday, and then two today, and then you're done with lab. So next week there's not going to be any lab. Don't show up to lab. The only thing that you have next week is your final exam, and that's Monday, May 21st at 10:30, and you get a full 2 hours for that. Yeah, question? Now, there might be a quiz. I'll have to check online. Yeah, there's probably an online quiz, too. Maybe the female reproductive system, but it's open. It's for you to take. You can take it right now if you want to get it out of the way, and I would, because that would help you prepare for the last lecture exam, okay? So that was just one way I could spread out the information. Maybe I spread it out too much. Okay, so I'll double check. So make sure that you finish everything up in Blackboard, okay? So there might be another online quiz due Tuesday, the 22nd at 11 p.m., if you're not done with that already. All right, well, I wasn't here on Monday, and I'm curious, did you guys feel like you were orphaned, or did I have a substitute? Did I have a substitute come in? Oh, good. That was the plan. Dr. Lee should have been here, and also for a lab practicum, and Professor Sato as well in the morning. So I tried to make sure you guys were taken care of, and that was good, right? Okay. You could tell me about it later, I suppose. So let's get on with the topics for today, unless there's another comment about our schedule. Okay, you guys are good? Okay, so I'll put that away. So before I start talking about the diversification system, remember we talked about this in lab, I really don't consider it the reproductive system because there's other ways of reproducing asexually. A lot of organisms just form little buds and organisms grow off of that bud and then that little baby organism is just like the parent. But what's special about sexual reproduction, the kind of reproduction that people go through, is what? What are the offspring like compared to the parents or compared to a parent? The offspring is? Like, are you exactly like your mom if you're a woman? Okay, if you're a guy in here, are you exactly like your dad? You might be similar to them, but you're certainly not exactly like them, right? So offspring from sexual reproduction is new and unique, and so it produces diversity within a population. And that's how I explain all these complicated structures. Let me find the cursor. Here it is. That's how I explain all these complicated structures, like why does a male have a penis and a scrotum and testes, and females have ovaries and uterus and vagina? Why is it all so complicated? Right, and the reason why it's also complicated because it's necessary to produce that diversity in a population, and that makes the population strong. All right, so the first thing that I want to just introduce you to briefly, I'm still kind of surprised that people, a lot of students haven't heard about this particular service or law, and it's called the Baby Safe Law. I don't think I mentioned this in lecture, so I want to take just a couple seconds to talk about this. This goes back way back to 1999, first passed in the legislature in Texas, and it just says that anybody that has a newborn baby, and the law varies a little bit from county to county, within 1 day or 2 days, maybe 48 hours, sometimes it's maybe even 3 days, if they surrender that newborn baby to a fire station or hospital or even a police station, then those parents or that parent has no legal obligation to provide for that infant. So that might seem a little gruesome, but the reason why this law came into effect was because sometimes mothers that can't take care of a baby, and these babies end up in a dumpster or something, right? They get murdered. And that's because somebody just isn't thinking clearly, and it only takes a second, right, for that life to be lost. So I know LA County and Orange County has passed these same kind of laws, and it's really important that everybody is aware of them. Not that I think you need this information, but it's just good to disseminate this information so that a newborn baby isn't lost just because of a moment of terrible confusion of a mother just at that moment, right? So And then that baby is put up for adoption. Okay, so who's not heard of this law before? A couple people haven't? Well, that's good. Most people are kind of learning of this law. That's really good, because we certainly can save some lives by passing that information around. Okay, the male reproductive system. The primary reproductive structure is the testes that we see right here on the diagram. And it has two functions. It produces sperm. Right, so one function is spermatogenesis, and the other function is for hormone secretion, in particular testosterone. And testosterone is a male sex hormone that promotes the development of male sexual characteristics. Like, what would be a male sexual characteristic? Okay, hair. More hair, of course, hair all over the body. Right, bigger, stronger bones compared to females. Deeper voice, because the larynx generally is larger and bigger, so vocal cords vibrate at a lower frequency. Okay, and then also the development of the genitalia, the male genitalia as well, which we're going to talk about. Okay, alright, secondary reproductive structures is the scrotum right here, which is outside the pelvic cavity, and it houses the testes, which is that primary organ. Alright, and the reason why the testes is in the scrotum, because spermatogenesis cannot take place at a normal body temperature. It has to be below body temperature. And if somebody would Google that and tell me what the highest temperature is, that would be nice. I don't really know. I feel silly that I'm talking about it and I don't know what that temperature is. Okay, so what temperature is optimal for spermatogenesis in the mammalian gonad? Okay. Okay, and we'll look at some structures that maintain a cooler temperature in the testes in just a little bit. It's part of the spermatic cord. All right, so sperm are produced in the testes right here, then they move into a bunch of coiled tubes, which start out microscopic, and they almost get to be a visible size, and we call this the epididymis. And it's a bunch of coiled tubes on the outside and posterior of the testes, and they stay in the epididymis until ejaculation takes place. And the reason why they're in the epididymis right here is because that's where a maturation process occurs. So that's where the sperm gain competency in swimming around. Maybe you could think of it as like learning to drive or something, right? That's when all the pieces of a sperm come together to make it motile. All right, when ejaculation takes place, all right, then smooth muscles contract and eject sperm from the epididymis into the vas deferens. And as you see, the vas deferens then has to carry the sperm into the pelvic cavity through the inguinal canal right here. And there are other components which make up the spermatic cord, but I just see the vas deferens right here, otherwise labeled ductus deferens in your book. All right, remember in a practicum, for instance, you only need to give me one correct answer, not all possible correct answers. And it goes over the anterior superior side of the bladder, of course, is posterior, and then goes inferiorly on the posterior side of the bladder, where the vas deferens enlarges and becomes the ampule of the vas deferens. And then there's another duct that comes from the seminal vesicle that adds volume to the ejaculate. All right, and then that volume is emptied into the ejaculatory duct, which is within the prostate gland, which is just inferior to the bladder. And here we see in the male reproductive system that the genital system, right, the reproductive system, namely this ejaculatory duct, and the urinary system fuse right at this point. They become a single structure. All right, so what is the structure that carries urine from the urinary bladder to the outside world? Generally, what do we call that? That's the urethra. All right, so the ejaculatory duct joins with the prostatic urethra, and then that becomes the membranous urethra through the urogenital diaphragm, which is skeletal muscle at the floor of the pelvic cavity. And there's also a voluntary circular skeletal muscle right at this junction, which is a backup device for controlling when the bladder voids. The involuntary muscle is right between the prostate and urinary bladder, right in this location right here. That's where the circular smooth muscle is, or the internal urethral sphincter. Here's the external urethral sphincter, part of the urogenital diaphragm. So that just helps control the flow of urine out of the bladder. And then the urethra becomes the spongy urethra because, or the penile urethra, because this component of the penis right here is called the corpus spongiosum. Hence, that's how the urethra got its name. And which includes also the glans penis as well. All right, so the corpus spongiosum is erectile tissue. You can see a bunch of sinuses in here that fill up with blood, and it attains an arterial pressure, right, that produces an erection. And the reason why that happens is because there's a smooth muscle sphincter that cuts off the venous return to the rest of the body when the penis is erect. The other erectile tissue in the penis is right here. There are two of them. I only see one on this diagram. If it's singular, we call it the corpus cavernosum. But if on a different view, like maybe a transverse section of the penis, we can see both of them, then it would be clearly labeled. The corpora cavernosa would be plural for them. All right, so just like the seminal vesicles, the prostate adds volume to the ejaculate, as well as this third gland right here, which is the bulbourethral gland. Bulbourethral gland mostly secretes mucus into the penile urethra. And that mucus has two functions. Of course, it's a lubricant, but since it's a protein, it also acts as a buffer. And a buffer just maintains the pH of its environment, right? And the pH then is adjusted within the urethra right here so it doesn't inactivate the sperm. So normally, the urethra is very acidic in both the male and the female, and that inhibits bacterial growth, which is an important function. But during ejaculation, okay, that would inactivate the sperm. And if the sperm are inactivated, what would happen? Well, we wouldn't be here, right? None of us would be here if all the sperm were inactivated. So that's very important for conception, to make sure you have motile sperm. All right, so that is most of the structures right here. Let's look at some of the special features of the testes that you have to be aware of. Okay, so let me take a look at this picture. Oh, here's a good one. Okay, because I see the spermatic cord. So let's talk about this slide. So here I see the ventral penis, and I can see underneath the skin right here, this is the penile urethra, the corpora cavernosa on either side. All right, but more importantly, what we can see on this diagram right here is the spermatic cord. And how about if I use the thumb wheel? Oh, good. I can zoom in a little bit because I want to see some details in this region right here. All right, so here is the vas deferens, which is taking sperm out of the scrotum into the pelvic cavity. That's part of the spermatic cord. But I also see a plexus of blood vessels in blue. And this is a systemic circulation. So what can you tell me about blue blood vessels in the systemic circulation? What are they? They're veins. Yeah, they're returning blood back to the heart. And this plexus forms a network around the vas deferens. But more importantly, this red, I think I see a little bit of a red structure right here. This is the testicular artery. Do you see red anywhere else in here? Here, testicular artery. Right here, testicular artery. Okay, so what did we say about spermatogenesis in this testes right here? It occurs, yeah, at below body temperature, right? So if this blood that's coming from the body quickly moves into the testes, then that would warm the testes up and defeat the purpose of it being in the scrotum. So as the arterial blood is being pumped into a testes right here, the artery lies right up against the veins in this plexus right here, and there is heat transfer. So there is heat from the artery that gets picked up by this pampiniform venous plexus right here, because the blood returning to the body from the scrotum has been cooled down, so the cold returning blood then absorbs some of the heat from the testicular artery, okay, which then maintains the testes here at a below the normal body temperature. And so that's not only important for spermatogenesis, but that's also important for the health of the testes, because if a testicle right here gets retained in the pelvic cavity, doesn't descend into the scrotum through the inguinal canal right here, then it always turns cancerous. All right, so if there is an undescended testicle, if it's hidden within the pelvic cavity, we call that cryptorchidism, right? Cryptic means like hidden knowledge, or something is hidden. And another name for A testes right here could be a orchid, right, or a gonad, right? But cryptorchidism is when a gonad, especially in the male, hasn't descended from the pelvic cavity into the scrotum, and then it will turn cancerous and, of course, kill the individual. So you've got the testicular artery, part of the spermatic cord, testicular vein, the vas deferens, and there's also a testicular nerve that's part of the spermatic cord, and some connective tissue sheaths, as well as a muscle, which we call the cremaster muscle. All right, so those are all things that form the spermatic cord. And then on the scrotum, there is another muscle as well that surrounds the whole scrotum, and that's called the dartos muscle. All right, so there are a number of muscles. Let's see what else we have. Okay, so here's a nice cross-section of the testes, and you can see a couple of different layers. All right, we can see the tunica vaginalis, which is a connective tissue capsule around the testes. It's like a serous membrane, and there's a serous fluid, a serous cavity called the cavity of the tunica vaginalis. All right, and then there is a white connective tissue that's deep to the vaginalis, right? We call that the tunica albuginea. And then there's invaginations of the albuginea into the testes, forming different lobes, right? So these invaginations are what we call septa. And in each of these lobes, there's microscopic tubules that we call seminiferous tubules. And that's where spermatogenesis takes place, within the seminiferous tubule. All right, when sperm are produced, then they move through little tubes right here out of the lobe, and this is called a straight tubule, and then into the Reedy's testes. This is a little plexus of tubes before it goes into an efferent ductule, and then it's in the epididymis where the sperm mature. Okay, so that's the fine structure of the scrotum. But I want to see some more details of a scrotum, which we see, of the tubules inside the testes. All right, so here is a seminiferous tubule on cross-section. And in this layer right here, there are some cells that are going to become sperm. They're going to differentiate to become sperm. And we call these germ cells. And some people call them stem cells, but I would prefer to call them germ cells because they're not going to produce a whole human cell. They're going to produce a cell that's half human. And that's what we call a gamete. And in a male, that's a sperm. So it's going to contain half the number of chromosomes. Right? So I do like germ cell because from a germ cell, you get sex cells, which contain half the number of chromosomes. Okay, we also have other cells in this area right here, which are called Sertoli cells or sustentacular cells. Right, which support spermatogenesis. They secrete nutrients that allow the germ cells to undergo spermatogenesis through a process that we call meiosis. Now, you've heard of mitosis a lot, okay? And can you remember the phases of mitosis? Like IPMAT, there's interphase, which is the growth phase, right? Then prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. And that just produces two daughter cells with exactly the same number of chromosomes. But for spermatogenesis through the process of meiosis, there are two rounds of cell division. And in that second round of cell division, then chromosomes are split into two separate cells. So the products or the four sperm cells that are formed, okay, then have half the number of chromosomes compared to every other cell in the human body. Right, so those are the cells that are in the seminiferous tubule. And then, since these seminiferous tubules are round, so here I see a seminiferous tubule, I see a seminiferous tubule, there are cells outside of the tubule right here. We call these interstitial cells because they're not inside the tubule, or cells of Leydig. And these cells right here are the cells that secrete testosterone. And testosterone is also necessary for spermatogenesis to take place, as well as secretions from the Sertoli cells. All right, so cells of Leydig secrete testosterone. Okay. So I think we've talked about all of this stuff right here, except some of the products of those glands that add volume to the ejaculate. and that is the seminal vesicles. Adds most of the volume to the ejaculate, about 60% of the semen volume comes from the seminal vesicles. It produces sperm nutrients. I'm not giving you the whole story on all these organs, but a pretty good story. All right, sperm nutrients, in particular fructose, which is a sugar molecule, which is necessary. Prostaglandins, and these prostaglandins stimulate contractility in the female reproductive tract to help deliver sperm. All right, and then sperm motility agents that activate the sperm, so they start swimming. Immunosuppressant chemicals, because the sperm that are produced in the male will be rejected by the female, because it's not part of her body, right? But these immunosuppressant agents then prevent rejection under most cases. Doesn't happen all the time, okay? But usually. And then there are semen coagulants, so that when semen is deposited in the vagina, part of the female anatomy, that sperm just doesn't run right out of the female body, but coagulates and then is slowly released, and of course that enhances conception as well. There are some pigments. We're not sure what the function of pigments are in semen, but they're easily observable with ultraviolet light. Okay. We have no idea what their function is. All right, so all those things from the seminal vesicles. All right, the prostate gland forms about 30% of the semen volume. It contains a neutralizing solution. What has to be neutralized? What has to be neutralized? The urethra. And within the male, and the right, and the vagina in the females, too acidic normally. Okay, that will inactivate the sperm, right, and some more motility agents, some more coagulants, and also there is a liquefying agent, which then slowly, right, liquefies the coagulated semen in the female vagina, which then slowly releases sperm over a period of time. Okay, and we talked about the bulbourethral gland already. It secretes mucus for what? Lubrication and neutralizing acid. And let's see, we did talk about the prostatic membranous and spongy urethra and the erectile tissue. All right, let's make sure you can see all of the erectile tissue. Oh, this is another nice diagram because you can see the ampule of the vas deferens and the seminal vesicles, the prostate, very nicely. Okay, bulbourethral gland within the urogenital diaphragm, and probably even, right, the external urethral sphincter. It's not labeled, but it's right here. Internal urethral sphincter is going to be way up in this region right here. So this is the voluntary muscle for controlling voiding, and this is the involuntary muscle between the prostate and the urinary bladder. All right, so let's look at the penis in particular. So now we can see the corpus spongiosum, and it's anchored up against the urogenital diaphragm with the bulb of the penis. So this is the corpus spongiosum coming down over here, which makes the gland penis. All right, and then we can see the two corpora cavernosa on either side of the corpus spongiosum, and that's anchored to the wall of the body cavity by the crus of the penis here and here. All right, so we have these three erectile tissues, and you can see the bilateral arrangement of the corpora cavernosa. Okay, so that's it for male reproductive system, at least as far as I want to talk about right now. I think we talked about in lab some unfortunate pathology associated with the prostate gland right here. And why is the prostate gland a lot like a guy's ears and nose, for instance? Because it keeps growing for the length of your life. Okay, they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. The prostate probably grows in most people even more than their ears and nose does. And when it grows, it occludes the urethra. It compresses the urethra. So males have a difficult time voiding. And there are two possible reasons for that. One is it could be a benign growth, which means then that tissue can't break away from the prostate and form a metastasis or a growing tumor in another part of the body. But it could be just as likely, or almost just as likely, to be a cancerous process, prostate cancer. which then the prostate cells break away from the prostate gland, right? They can move up into the seminal vesicles, right? They can go through the capsule of the prostate gland, and the prostate gland also has blood vessels. Those cancer cells can get into the blood vessels and go everywhere in the body, including bone, brain, liver, and there are nerves that go into the prostate gland, and cancer cells are pretty tricky because they could like to get into a nerve and then travel along a nerve to get into other regions of the body as well. So there are a number of different exit points for cancer cells from the prostate everywhere. And we said that every male in here will have to deal with that situation if you're lucky enough to live a long life, like into your 70s or 80s. Okay, and how would you first notice that condition developing? It might be subtle because it might happen just a little bit at a time every year. You might experience difficulty in voiding, okay? Which means then you have to void more frequently because you can't void completely when you try. Okay, female reproductive system. We're going to talk about next, unless you got a question. Questions about male reproductive system? Okay, female reproductive system. Primary reproductive structure in the female reproductive system is her gonad, or orchid, which is called what? Ovary. Right. Okay, so let's look at a nice sagittal section, sort of like a sagittal section, but it's a lateral view. We can see some depth into the pelvic cavity. Here is the ovary right here. And it's anchored firmly within the pelvic cavity by a number of ligaments, most notably the ovarian ligament that comes from the uterus, which is part of the broad ligament that lines the pelvic cavity. Okay, but it's not directly associated with the other organs of the female reproductive tract. It's a separate organ. And there is a site of incomplete communication with the rest of the reproductive system, and that is the opening of the fallopian tube, which is what we call the fimbria. All right, so the job of this ovary right here, just like in the testes in the male, is to produce sex steroids and to produce gametes, that half-human cell. So there are germ cells within the ovary, okay, that develop, and these develop actually before a person is born. And where an egg comes from is called a follicle. So before somebody's born, oogenesis takes place. And the germ cells produce all of the possible eggs that a female will ever have in her lifetime, which is on the order of 5 million at the beginning of that process. Right? So spermatogenesis in males takes place throughout their whole lifespan. So probably millions of sperm every day are produced. Okay, the female, okay, that's not so. Only before birth does she develop these reproductive cells. So you might feel kind of bad about that, right? If you're a woman, maybe because you don't produce these reproductive cells throughout your whole lifespan. But since there's so many of them, I've never met anybody who wants to have a million children anyway, right? So there's more than enough. All right, but there is attrition. They start to die almost immediately. So by the time when you're born, there's only a couple hundred thousand of these egg cells. But then again, I've never met anybody who wants more than a couple hundred thousand offspring anyway, right? So that's plenty. Okay. So then, so that's the job of the ovary right here, produce those oocytes and also produce some sex steroids. In the male, it's testosterone, but in the female, there are two. There's estrogen, which is kind of the analog to testosterone, but there's another one called progesterone, and that's important for gestation, which is the period of time of, what, embryo and fetal development within the uterus, right, before parturition takes place. All right, so maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some of those hormones. In the female. Okay, so these fimbria, this lacy edge, this feathery edge right here, is constantly moving and sweeping over the ovary, and it has a ciliated epithelium, and the cilia are sweeping and beating, so there is peritoneal fluid that moves from the peritoneum or pelvic cavity down through the fallopian tube into the uterus. And an egg is not motile like a sperm. It has no cilia, has no flagellum. And so it just goes with the flow. So if there is an occlusion of a fallopian tube, maybe due to a pelvic inflammatory disease or other kind of abnormality, then an egg won't flow like it does naturally down to the ovary, but will be trapped in part of the fallopian tube, or maybe it will just even float around in some part of the pelvic cavity or float around in some part of the abdominal cavity. Remember, that's all part of the peritoneal cavity. So the function of the epithelium is very important because a viable pregnancy can only be maintained in the uterus. It can't be maintained in the pelvic cavity, fallopian tube, or abdominal cavity. If there is fertilization that takes place, because remember, sperm are motile. They can and do swim everywhere, right, from the vagina through the cervical canal, through the uterus, through the fallopian tube, out the fallopian tube, everywhere in the peritoneal cavity, and fertilization can take place anywhere. And then implantation can take place on the exterior wall of the fallopian tube, within the mesentery of the digestive tract, right, or on the perimetrium of the uterus right here, and that's what we call an ectopic pregnancy, and that's not a viable pregnancy, and in most cases, okay, it is fatal because there's no muscles that can hold the implanted embryo, and when it breaks away from that blood supply, that causes a massive hemorrhage, right, which, unless you're right there in the hospital, is probably a fatal occurrence. Okay, so parts of this fallopian tube, okay, we have the infundibulum, just distal to the fimbria, all right, and then here's your book calls it the uterine tube, and then there's a little narrowing right here that we call the isthmus of the fallopian tube. We can maybe see that on another diagram when I show that to you. All right, so here is the muscular organ for maintaining pregnancy. And it's got three layers. The outer layer is the perimetrium. The muscle layer right here is the myometrium. And then the inner layer is the endometrium. And it's this endometrium that grows during at least the reproductive years once a month. It's controlled by the ovarian cycle. And that produces a uterine cycle. So this area right here grows, meaning that these cells divide by mitosis. When you start with one cell and then you have two and then four and then eight, we call that proliferation. So it's the endometrium that proliferates. And then if implantation does not take place, those proliferated cells are then lost from the body so the cycle can start again in a period of just mild hemorrhage, and the endometrial cells then are sloughed out of the body through the birth canal, which is what? The cervical canal and the vagina right here. Okay, mostly that happens. Some of those endometrial cells can actually move retrograde through the fallopian tube and then out of the fallopian tube into the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity. And in some women, those cells are viable. They can implant, right, and get nutrients from the blood supply, the mesentery or the perimetrium right here, and they might have a long life. And then once a month, they'll proliferate and grow and cause inflammation and irritation in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And in some women, that is extremely uncomfortable. And I'm not sure of all the ways that it can be treated. But at menopause, and that is when a woman stops cycling, I think the good news is that that endometriosis then goes into abeyance or regresses. Okay, but in some cases, surgery might be required. But what is the consequence of surgery in all cases? Remember, endometriosis causes inflammation and scarring of the pelvic cavity right here. But if you try to treat that with surgery, what does that produce as well? Inflammation and scarring, right? So you need to talk with a good physician and use good clinical judgment to see if you're helping somebody more, right, or hurting somebody more. And it's always sometimes a tough call. Okay, so here's the myometrium. At this end of the uterus right here, the myometrium forms a dome-shaped structure with the cervical canal, which is the cervix. And then these indentations right here, these are what we call the fornices. Here's the anterior fornix, here's the posterior fornix. But remember, that is just a really nice circular structure at the base of the cervix. And so there are also the lateral fornices that you should be aware of. And then here is the other part of the birth canal. But what's another function of the vagina? It accepts the male penis and sperm, right, for conception to take place. And that's pretty important. Humans are pretty successful, biologically speaking, compared to other kinds of plants and animals, because lots of plants and animals just release their gametes into the environment. And then the chances of even running into a female of the same species is so remote. So this just enhances conception and viability of the species. Okay, here's a bulbourethral, Bartholin's gland, greater vestibular gland. That's the analog to the male bulbourethral gland. Again, it secretes mucus, right, for lubrication, for penetration, but also for regulating pH. That's very important, because in the female, I was thinking of urethra right here. Obviously, the vagina is female, okay? But the vagina normally is acidic to prevent bacterial infection, as well as the urethra right here. And the bulbourethral gland helps adjust the environment, the pH of the vagina, so that sperm are not inactivated. Okay, here I can see the urogenital diaphragm very nicely once again. Okay, we saw it in the male. And going through the urogenital diaphragm is the vagina and the urethra separately. In the female reproductive system, the urinary system and reproductive system never join together like you do see in the male. They're always separated, and that just prevents infection of the female reproductive tract, right? Because remember how important that is, because you want to maintain good function of this fallopian tube. You don't want it to be scarred. You don't want any damage to the ciliated epithelium, because that puts somebody at a much higher risk of ectopic pregnancy. Okay. The other thing that's noteworthy is look how short this urethra is right here. Females are much more prone to bladder infections just because the female urethra is shorter compared to the male. The internal urethral sphincter is right here, and the external. The internal is under involuntary control, and the external is under voluntary control. Sometimes this urethral sphincter gets a little bit damaged with pregnancy and with age, and then a woman has to rely on this external urethral sphincter, which is the voluntary muscle, to prevent incontinence. Right, incontinence is just involuntary loss of urine from the bladder, involuntary voiding of the bladder. And so exercising of these muscles right here, most notably the coccygeneous muscle, but all the muscles of the urogenital diaphragm then can back up the action of this internal urethral sphincter right here and prevent incontinence. Anybody know what that exercise is? It's called a Kegel exercise, Kegel with a K. Okay, and then we have the vestibule right here. The vestibule is a space. It's protected by lips. The labium minorum and labium majorum right here, and the labia and the clitoris and the bulbourethral gland and the orifice of the vagina and urethra make up the vulva of the female. It's not diagrammed on this slide. Okay, and you can see that the counterpart to the male erectile tissue is the clitoris right here, so it does have sinuses that engorge with blood. Okay, and it's highly innervated. And that just helps promote proper sexual response for conception, right? Just for maintenance of the species. Okay, let's move on to a nice anterior section. We can see the lateral fornices of the cervix. The opening of the cervical canal from inside the uterus, we call that the internal os. The opening from the vagina is called the external os, and we can see the three layers of the uterus very nicely, the perimetrium, myometrium, and endometrium right here. Okay, and here is the fundus of the stomach, which is the top part. It's the region of the uterus that's farthest away from the cervical canal or birth canal. And then the body of the uterus is right here. So fundus is always on top. And then we can see all the other parts of the fallopian tube. Notice your book calls it uterine tube. I call it fallopian tube. And then here's the isthmus, right? Here's the ampule. Here's the fimbria. And then here's the infundibulum right here. And it all has a nice ciliated columnar epithelium. Right, and now we can see the ligaments very nicely. Okay, here's the ovarian ligament, here's the round ligament, and then here's the broad ligament that ties all of these structures together. And then on this kind of presentation, you can see the whole fallopian tube, and it looks like a musical instrument. Right, what is that musical instrument? I'm sure I mentioned this in lab. It's a trumpet, okay? And another name for trumpet is salpinx. Right, so that's why this part of the broad ligament is called the mesosalpinx, because it connects up to the fallopian tube. And every once in a while, maybe somebody is infertile and they want to find out why. They want to look at the patency of this fallopian tube, so they want an image to see if this tube is open all the way to the uterus. And maybe they want to look at the shape of the lumen of the uterus right here. Right, and they get a hysterosalpingogram, which is kind of a weird term. You don't hear that term every day. But a hysterosalpingogram is a picture of the salpinx, or a fallopian tube, just a view to see if it is an open tube that's patent, or if it does have scar tissue and is closed, or if there are small occlusions along the line, which would then make that person infertile or highly susceptible to ectopic pregnancies. All right, before we move on, we talked about cancer in the male. Some labs, I forgot to talk about cancer in the female. Okay, and certainly, just like in the male, can have testicular cancer. That can happen in the female. She could have ovarian cancer. But there is another kind of cancer that I feel that I have to talk about, because it's so preventable and 100% curable, but yet almost 10,000 women in the United States die every year. And that's cervical cancer. All right, so I always kind of start out by asking, is cancer a sexually transmitted disease? And a lot of people, most people still think, well, obviously cancer is not sexually transmitted disease. But consider this. There is a virus called human papillomavirus. We know of at least 104 different strains of that virus. Four of those strains can infect the cervix right here, and after a period of years, the normal cervical cells, right, become dysplastic. That means they become abnormal and then turn cancerous as a result of that viral infection. So indeed, human papillomavirus does cause cervical cancer, right, and it can only be transmitted through sexual intercourse. So I kind of just link all those concepts up together and say that, well, for sure, sexually transmitted disease, in the case specifically of human papillomavirus, right, does cause cancer in women. All right, so just to be aware of that. So how can you protect yourself? Oh, not so many sex partners, okay, or never have sex, right? Probably not really good options. Okay, and also there is a vaccine that is now available. And it's called Gardasil. There's maybe another vaccine that's out that helps prevent the infection of the cervix right here, which then stops the progression of these cells into cancer cells. So a person has a number of options. And then, of course, if your sex partner will always use a condom, that prevents sexually transmitted diseases as well. So you have a number of opportunities at that level. But even if you do have a precancerous stage on the cervix to protect yourself from cancer, you can get a yearly pap smear where some of the cells are removed. A pathologist looks at those cells and can diagnose if those cells are normal or if they're pathologic or if they're cancerous. And it takes years, maybe a decade, sometimes maybe even two decades for these abnormal cells to turn into cancer cells. So there's plenty of time to catch this disease process and stop the progression by little cryoablation. Little liquid nitrogen on certain parts of the cervix will kill those cells, okay, before they turn cancerous, which is a relatively easy procedure, right, compared to if you have cancer that has metastasized to other parts of your body, then sometimes you just have no choice of what to do. Can't be treated. Okay, so just be aware of that. And the other thing is, human papillomavirus, as far as we know, is completely benign, is not pathologic in the human body. So a male is completely unaware if they're a carrier for human papillomavirus, but I think today there is a test for human papillomavirus. It might be a blood test to look for an antigen. for human papillomavirus. I don't know the importance of that, but it might be available if somebody's interested. Okay, let's see, what are some other things that I should be talking about right here? Cervix, we talked about that. Okay, yeah, the ligaments. All right, so the broad ligament does tie the pelvic cavity, the wall of the pelvic cavity to the uterus, to the fallopian tube, and to the ovary as well. So it anchors all of these structures in location within the pelvic cavity. And then parts of the broad ligament, right, include the ovarian ligament right here. So this goes from the uterus to the ovary. And then there's an additional ligament, round ligament, that goes from the wall of the uterus near the isthmus right here, near the orifice of the fallopian tube, over to the pelvic cavity. Right, so there are a number of ligaments that hold all of these structures in place. Maybe not so important, okay, under normal everyday life, but if implantation and pregnancy occurs, then, of course, these ligaments are really helpful to stabilize this whole region right here. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the reproductive system. Let me just look at some other slides. I do want to show you something about these guys right here. All right, so here's a sperm. The sperm has three main regions. It has a headpiece, a midpiece, and a tail. All right, there's some cytoplasm, very, very little in the headpiece. It's mostly just the nucleus. And this nucleus right here contains only half of the normal number of chromosomes compared to all the rest of the cells. Okay, and in the cytoplasm, there's some fluid, but there really aren't any organelles. When I look at, right, the developing sperm over here, I can see a lot of mitochondria that are going to produce ATP. But in a mature sperm cell, there are no mitochondria making ATP. That has sort of an interesting ramification. Here is the acrosome. This is a part of the sperm that contains some enzymes that allow for the penetration of the headpiece for fertilization when it bumps into an oocyte. And when an oocyte membrane gets dissolved away a little bit by this acrosome, then the genetic material within the headpiece, right, is inserted into the ovum, right, where it joins up with the genetic material within the ovum, which is, again, half of the usual number of chromosomes in a normal human cell. So now you have these two half-human cells joining together to form what? A whole human cell that has all the chromosomes necessary, right, and all the information necessary to make a human. Okay, what is that process called? When this genetic material from a sperm joins with the genetic material from an oocyte, what do we call that process? That's fertilization, right? And it forms a single cell. Does anybody know what that single cell is called? It is called a zygote. Probably not bad for you to know, a zygote. So a zygote contains all the chromosomes that a normal human will have, but a gamete, like a sperm or an oocyte, only has half the number. Okay, the midpiece right here just are some contractile elements that regulate the microtubules that are inside the flagellum. All right, so when fertilization takes place, only the genetic material enters the oocyte. Right, the oocyte has all the organelles that a normal human cell has, including mitochondria. And way back when, what was something interesting that we learned about in terms of mitochondria? They're like little aliens living inside your body, inside every cell. Okay, they're like bacteria, and bacteria have their own DNA, their own genetic material. All right, so mitochondria have a chromosome. All right, so where do all the chromosomes in you currently come from? Do they come from your dad, from your mom, or from both? Okay, look right here. See these mitochondria? They are lost. They're not part of the genetic material that is injected into the oocyte during fertilization. All right, so That zygote contains mitochondria only from the female. There's only maternal mitochondrial DNA in the embryo. There's no paternal DNA, mitochondrial DNA in the embryo. And so that's a kind of a powerful technique to investigate lineages or relationships between people by looking at that maternal DNA that we all carry. We don't carry any DNA from our dads, mitochondrial DNA from our fathers, which is sort of interesting, just because of how the sperm develops. Okay. This slide here just shows these primordial follicles and how they develop into secondary follicles. And then once a month, one of these secondary follicles will develop into a mature follicle. And then right at mid-cycle, this oocyte is going to be expelled through that process of ovulation from a follicle. Right, so here is the ovulated oocyte. This is the thing that can be fertilized to become a zygote. The follicle, the remnant of the follicle, okay, becomes an important endocrine structure. It doesn't dissolve away immediately. It becomes something we call the corpus luteum. And it lives for about another 14 days if implantation does not take place. Right? And it's important because it starts to secrete a hormone called progesterone. So these follicles that are developing during the monthly cycle secrete a hormone primarily which is estrogen, which causes development within the breast, but also the uterine changes within the endometrium. Okay, and then at this later point in time, after ovulation, then estrogen levels start to decrease because the follicle disappears and it becomes the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum then starts to secrete progesterone, which maintains the endometrium for implantation. And then if implantation doesn't take place, then the corpus luteum regresses and goes away. Right. If implantation does take place, then the growing placenta secretes a hormone that tells the corpus luteum to stick around because a viable pregnancy has taken place. And that hormone is called human chorionic gonadotropin, and that's the actual hormone that people measure in their urine when they're trying to find out if they're pregnant or not. Right. So that hormone, HCG or human chorionic gonadotropin, is coming from the placenta and telling the corpus luteum to stick around and maintain and keep secreting progesterone because a pregnancy is in process. So a lot of these different structures are coordinated by endocrines in the body. So let's take a look at I thought I put in a picture from our physiology book here. Oh, I don't see. Oh, good. I did. Okay. Or this is a picture that's very similar to the one that's in your book. Okay, but it's all put on one figure instead of two different figures. I can see a number of different things happening right here. So we're thinking about the female reproductive system. All right, I can see a couple graphs and a couple illustrations. So this graph right over here shows events within the ovarian cycle. So what organ are we talking about when we say ovarian cycle? The ovary in particular, yes, things that are happening inside the ovary. And then these graphs down here are depictions of the menstrual cycle. And when we talk about the menstrual cycle, what organ are we talking about? Not the ovary because that's up over here, but the, in particular, yeah, the uterus. Okay, so let's So here are some changes during the monthly cycle within the uterus, and we call that the menstrual cycle. And then here are some changes that we see within an ovary over the monthly cycle. We call that the ovarian cycle. All right, so ovarian versus menstrual cycle. All right, so we have a couple hormones. We talked about these hormones already. These are gonadotropins. There are two. There's FSH and LH. We see two different levels, and these are plotted out via days of the cycle, the monthly cycle. And a monthly cycle is typically 28 days long, which I see right here. All right, so right at mid-cycle would be day 14. Right? Day one of the cycle is characterized by the loss of the endometrium within the uterus. Right? So it's being sloughed off, and this layer is highly vascular. That also produces a mild hemorrhage, and the endometrium, in all good cases, is lost via the vagina to the outside world, as opposed to going into the pelvic cavity, as it does sometimes. All right, and so that's the beginning of the cycle. And what dominates the cycle at this point in time is a hormone called follicle-stimulating hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone is secreted by, anybody know where that comes from? Anybody remember where that comes from? The pituitary, and in particular the anterior pituitary. It's stimulated into secreting FSH by something called GnRH from the hypothalamus, gonadotropin-releasing hormone. So FSH levels are high. They're released into the blood, they go to the ovary, and they cause a follicle to mature. It starts to grow. It proliferates. And this follicular tissue then is responsible for secreting estrogen. All right, so FSH from the anterior pituitary causes estrogen to be released from the ovary, and that causes the growth, the regrowth of the endometrium during the first half of the cycle. All right, so this part of the cycle where a follicle is growing, we call that the follicular phase of the ovarian cycle. And during the follicular phase, it's FSH that is causing increased levels within the female, increased levels of estrogen within the female. Okay, as it gets to mid-cycle, we see that LH is predominantly being released from the anterior pituitary. Right, so there's a big spike in LH right here, and then it can affect the mature follicle and cause it to ovulate. Right, so during this part of the cycle, there's an interesting phenomenon that's going on, and that is that there's an increase in LH, which causes a steep rise in estrogen levels, and estrogen then feeds back to the hypothalamus, or an increasing estrogen feeds back to the hypothalamus, which then causes an increase in LH, which then causes an increase in estrogen, which causes an increase in LH, which causes an increase in estrogen. Okay, so we have this big spike in luteinizing hormone. All right, so that kind of feedback mechanism is what we call a positive feedback mechanism. It's highly atypical, because usually positive feedback mechanisms produces a disease state in people. A way to think of another positive feedback mechanism that would cause a disease state would be, say, if your body temperature, maybe because you started to exercise, increased, right? Positive feedback would mean then something would happen inside your body to make your temperature increase even further, okay? And if that is increasing your body temperature, then that would cause that mechanism to make your body temperature even go higher, right? Which would then do what? Make your body temperature go higher and higher and higher and higher. And then what would happen with that positive feedback mechanism working on your body temperature? What would happen to your body? If a rise in body temperature would cause your body temperature to increase, if that were to keep happening, what would happen to you? Well, yeah, that's what we call hyperthermia, right? Heat stroke, and then you would die. You just explode into a big ball of flames. Spontaneous human combustion. Actually, that never happens, but you would certainly die of hyperthermia. Okay, so positive feedback mechanisms are pretty rare. That does not happen because it takes you away from your normal condition, which your normal body temperature is what? 98.6. Okay. Here's an example of a positive feedback mechanism that's important. It produces what? Ovulation. And when ovulation happens, then that positive feedback mechanism is disturbed because the follicle is no longer there. It becomes what? What does it become? What does a mature follicle become after ovulation? I think that's important for you guys to know. That becomes the corpus luteum. All right. Okay, so after ovulation, the follicle disappears, so estrogen levels start to decrease, and the corpus luteum right here takes over, puts the final maturation touches on the endometrium, and prevents regression of the endometrium, and that also keeps it very quiet, keeps the smooth muscle of the uterus very quiet, and it causes maturation of glands within the endometrium that aid in implantation. All right, so progesterone is released from the corpus luteum. But a developing follicle, what hormone is released from the developing follicle? It is estrogen. And when a follicle becomes a corpus luteum, it starts to secrete progesterone, and then levels of estrogen start to decrease. Another name for progesterone is called progestational hormone. What's gestation once again? Pregnancy. So progestational hormone is just a hormone that maintains gestation. Right? So when there's high levels of progesterone, then a female's body thinks that they're pregnant as a result, and that maintains the endometrium. Okay. If implantation does not take place, a placenta does not develop, the placenta doesn't send human chorionic gonadotropin into the corpus luteum, and then the corpus luteum regresses during that period of time if implantation does not take place. And as the corpus luteum regresses, look what happens to progesterone. It starts to decrease. And when progesterone decreases day after day after day, what happens to the endometrium? It gets left off, right? So it regresses, it dies, it gets left off, and then the cycle is reset once again. Okay, so when we look at the phases of the uterine cycle, we can see that the phase of where you're losing the endometrium, we call that menstruation. The phase, the first part of the uterine cycle, when the endometrium is growing, we call that the proliferative phase, because remember, proliferation is when cells are growing, the endometrium is growing, right? And the third phase then is called the secretory phase, because there are glands within the endometrium that secrete substances, right, that aid in implantation. And we're not exactly sure of all those different substances are and haven't classified their names and things like that. So we're not going to talk about that. All right, so some important questions when you look at this diagram right here. The proliferative phase of the uterus is controlled primarily by what hormone when you look at this? The proliferative phase is controlled primarily by estrogen. And where does estrogen come from? The follicle within the ovary. And what's causing this follicle to grow? It is FSH. Okay. In the secretory phase of the uterine cycle, that's after ovulation, okay, during the secretory phase, what hormone is primarily in control? We can see decreased levels of estrogen, so it is progesterone. So progesterone is controlling and maintaining the endometrium during the secretory phase. And where does that progesterone come from? Your two choices would be a follicle or the corpus luteum. And so you would choose the corpus luteum. So the corpus luteum secretes progesterone, maintains the endometrium. Okay? And my last question would be, how many hormones do you see? Actually, I have a couple more questions. How many hormones do you see on this slide right here? I see estrogen. What else? Progesterone, FSH, and LH. So I see four hormones. Sort of like there's four chambers in the heart, only because of the number four, right? But I see four hormones right here. Which one, okay, and it's not a trick question, there's only one, but which one is the most important for ovulation? If you had to pick one, it is luteinizing hormone. There are interactions between all these different hormones, okay? But it is luteinizing hormone. If you were just going to pick one, luteinizing hormone causes ovulation. Follicle stimulating hormone causes the maturation of a follicle. Estrogen causes the development of the endometrium. Progesterone maintains the endometrium for implantation. So that's how I would think about those different hormones. Okay, so that's the endocrine control during the ovarian and menstrual cycle. All right. The sign-in sheet is going around. And don't forget, last test. You don't have it? Oh, it's in somebody's book here? Is it going around? Who has, oh, it's coming down. Good, 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 good. Okay, so sign-in sheet is here. That's the end of the class. Some of you might have a practicum today, but don't forget your final on Monday, 10:30, in this room. And I'll turn the lights on, so you'll be able to work on your test.